With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Hello everybody, and a very warm welcome to the first of the Motorsport Magazine podcasts of 2012. Half a century since Graham Hill won the World Championship in a BRM. It's quite a conversation stopper, I think. Anyway, on we go, and as you know, the Motorsport Magazine podcast, we have one every month. And we bring you the very top people, the inside stories from the past and from the present, without hacking a single mobile phone. Anyway, today we start at the top, where we continue to stay throughout the year. We have Pat Simmons with us from, obviously, you will remember, Benetton, Renault, and now with Marussia, the new Formula One team, which used to be called Virgin. We have our usual team on board, Nigel Roebuck, Ed Foster and Damien Smith. We are going to tell you about something quite exciting, which many of you will know by now, but we have an iPad version of Motorsport Magazine. Yep, we are with it here. If you're already a subscriber to our printed magazine, you can access every issue now on your iPad, absolutely free. And if you're not a subscriber, you can buy individual copies on the newsstand or become a digital subscriber. Yep. It's the same content, only there's more of it, including extra photographs and slideshows, videos and links to audio podcasts like this one and to our Motorsport Magazine website. So hopefully you have an iPad. If you don't, that's all irrelevant. Pat, we haven't even started testing for the 2012 Formula One season yet, but this might be something quite close to your heart, I think, because we're already getting details about a reactive ride height suspension system that Lotus and Ferrari will have. Can you explain to us what might be this reactive ride height suspension system?
Well, I think we have to emphasise the might, actually, because obviously we haven't seen it yet. We've seen some drawings, we've seen some illustrations, I'd call them, in the magazines. And I think basically that really everything is about controlling the front ride height of these Formula One cars at the moment. And of course, with so much downforce on the cars, the faster they go, the more they're squashed down into the ground. And so lots of things are done to try and mitigate that effect and to keep the car at a constant ride height, because you don't want the car very high up in the air at low speed just because it gets pushed down at high speed. And I think the system that Lotus have been working on, and is Ferrari are claiming they've been working on a similar thing, is something that mitigates this problem of the car being squashed down into the ground. Now, exactly how it works, I don't think any of us know yet. I think that we've seen the illustrations that show that it's a sort of hydraulic system that's linked to the push rods. What we do know is that it has to be entirely passive. It can't be an intelligent control device like active suspension, because of course that would be illegal. So something quite clever there. What's it going to be worth? Well, of course, you know, everyone's claiming the 0.3 of a second that seems to be the come straight out of the book for claiming everything that's new. I would doubt that. I think it's a nicety. It's definitely icing on the cake. But I think we're going to see perhaps some more interesting things this year.
The thing is that you're quite well known for innovation in engineering. It's what you do, isn't it? When you hear about something like this, do you think, oh, I should have thought of that or not?
Yes. Always. Not so much with that one, but you know, some of the things that have happened in the past. I mean, the F duct, for example, I think was just a fantastic bit of lateral thinking. Other things, you know, over the last few years, something like the double diffuser, I'm not so convinced. You know, to this day, I think that was really a bit of a travesty of the rules, and it came down to semantics in a way that was way beyond, you know, what the general public would ever be expected to understand, and that's not a good thing for the sport.
Okay. Well, I mean, Formula One really would not be Formula One unless we had this kind of thing going on, and would it? I mean, it is very typical, isn't it? Especially in the modern era, of someone to come up with something apparently very clever. And I guess it remains to be seen whether it becomes something that everyone's going to have, or it's a failure. It could go either way, could it?
Yeah, it could. I think the important thing, though, is what you said initially. It is part of the mystique of Formula One. And I was quite gratified when FOTA did what I think has been the only real market research into Formula One. And by that, I mean, you know, it wasn't based on a motorsport website or anything like that. It really was going out and doing it scientifically. I was very pleased that technology figured quite high. In fact, I think it was third in the sort of list of attractors to Formula One. And of course, as an engineer, that pleased me. And I think that this sort of thing is something that gets people talking, even if they don't understand all the nuances of it. They don't need to. It's the fact that there is something technical, supposedly leading edge, and indeed, if there's a little bit of mystery about it, that's actually not a bad thing either.
No, I agree. But I mean, Nigel Roebuck is not a fan of the gizmos, are you, Nigel?
I'm fundamentally not a fan of anything that I think the driver should do. But that's why I always hated traction control, because to me it was an abomination that. Yeah, that was one of the things that has separated the Clarks and the Senna's and the whatnot from the, you know, yep, the riffraff.
Riffraff. Thank you.
Over time, and it struck me. I remember, you know, when I think probably 93 was the height of the gizmo. I mean, we even had ABS brakes, you know, at that time. And it always struck me as significant that the two drivers who hated all that the most were Senna and Prost, because inevitably, you know, it was diminishing what they had over most of the others, so you could understand that.
Can I just say, but my favourite cars, of course, were the 93 cars.
Well, I'm, that doesn't surprise me at all. But
I wonder why.
No. Absolutely. Honestly, that really doesn't surprise me, Pat, because that's, you know, that's.
It was engineering at its height.
Of course, it absolutely was.
But I do have a lot of sympathy for your view, and I do agree with your view. I do actually think that they were way over the top of a combined sport. You know, it's not an engineering exercise. That's just part of it. Mm. And I do think the 93 cars were way beyond the pale.
Yeah.
I mean, but you've also worked with some absolutely wonderful drivers, and we've seen Vettel these past 2 years reign supreme. But I mean, you've worked with Schumacher, you've worked with Alonso. Is that a 0.3 factor for you?
Funnily enough, yes, I think it is. I think even more so in the old days. Now, I worked with Senna in his early days, and I think he was worth more than that, because, you know, the driver was more important because there was less engineering support around him. Yeah. And when I worked with Senna in the 80s, you relied on the driver to do an awful lot of things that these days you wouldn't even think about. Simple things, you know, what's the water temperature, what's the oil temperature? The guy had to look at a gauge, you know, just like in your road car, and he had to remember the numbers, and he had to tell you when he came back to the pits. I mean, it's inconceivable these days, but, you know, they were worth a lot, those guys. And those who can do all those sort of things, and of course there's a lot less these days, but you still want the guy thinking about what's making the car go quick. Those that can do that without losing time are worth that 0.3, 0.4, 0.5.
Do you think nowadays, I mean, the cars being so aerodynamically developed, are we getting back into that stage where, I mean, it's very, a lot of drivers can come into F1 having never driven a Formula One car. and be sort of there or thereabouts almost straight away? Do you think, you know, we were talking about obviously Senna and Prost hating all the gizmos because it made the, as you put it, like the riffraff being able to compete on almost a level terms with it.
Relative,
I mean, are we a bit like that now with aerodynamics?
No, I don't think so, because the difference between there and thereabouts is enormous. You know, that's the difference between a champion and a driver. That's the difference between Premier League and your local football ground. And there's no doubt in my mind that it's the driver that contributes that last bit. And I don't think, yes, aerodynamics are getting such that cars are less likely to be aerodynamically unstable and things like that. So yes, maybe a little bit easier to drive. I've been working a lot in the last few months really with trying to push our aerodynamicists to make the car easier to drive, because now I'm working in a team that has, well, one inexperienced driver. You know, I think these sort of things are important. But I certainly wouldn't go as far as saying it makes life easy. It's not easy to drive a Formula One car, I'm sure.
Actually, I think we wanted to talk to you about the rookie, Charles. Is it Pick or Peak?
Pick.
Well, it's that simple. Is it the shortest ever surname in Grand Prix racing? Anyway, how do you think he'll go? And it's quite a challenge, isn't it? And he's got Glock there, who's quick, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Timo is quick. He's bright. He works hard. It comes naturally to him. And I think with Charles, you know, he, like all rookies, he's got a lot to learn. And it was quite interesting, you know, that when these guys go to the young drivers test in Abu Dhabi, you actually see a difference between those who've just had some exposure and those who haven't. And even something simple like doing the straight line testing that we all do to do our aerodynamics and everything, the guy just gets, you know, he works with the team, he gets an idea of what the multitude of controls on the steering wheel do, he gets to know some of the terminology and things like that. And with Charles, he hadn't had that initiation, for want of a better word, and it shows. So it's, you know, it's just another hill to climb on the way to the mountain, and it's damn hard work for these guys. But I think by having a good atmosphere in the team, you know, and helping them, and not being a prima donna and saying, well, you know, what does this guy know? He's only just started. Yeah, that's the worst thing to do. You've got to welcome him into the team. You've got to put your arm around their shoulder and say, come on, look, we'll do this together.
Yeah, because confidence is a big thing, isn't it?
Right. Self-esteem in any sport is everything. It really is. You know, it's what made Nigel Mansell what he was. And I think particularly with the young guys, they've got to have that.
He's going to say, never had a problem with self-esteem.
He's on form this morning, Mr. Rover. We've had the riffraff, and we're about to go to Mansell.
Forgive my interrupting, Robert, but I'm just at the moment reading Peter Waugh's book, his memories of Lotus, and the memories, obviously, of Chapman and the drivers and so on. But he reminded me in there of just talking about the rules at any given time in Formula One. And I remember Chapman saying this, and it came back to me when I reread it, that fundamentally Colin believed Formula One should be, there should be strict rules about engine size, there should be strict rules about the fuel you can use, and there should be a box into which every Formula One car can fit from length, width, and height. Other than that, get on with it. Would that be... I mean, that obviously was a sort of dream scenario. Would you feel the same about that?
My engineer's hat on, of course I would. I'd love it. If I really want to look after the sport, no, I don't think it's a good thing. And you know, it's interesting, because, of course, Colin was a chassis guy. So you'd expect him to say, well, you know, let's have a standard engine, let's play with the chassis. If you'd asked Tony Rudd at that time, he'd have probably said, well, you know, go and buy a car and let's have free engines in it. You know, it's all a matter of opinion. But the fact is that in those days, you know, teams were small. And it was about innovation. The rule book was 30 pages. No, it wasn't 30 pages. It was less than that. Even when I started, it was less than that. So there was innovation. There was the culture of innovation as well, rather than the culture of the lawyer, you know, does this comply with the rules and everything. But if that had been allowed to proliferate, there is no doubt it would have become an arms race, you know. Okay, it has, I know, but it would have got even worse. And I think one of the things we did very well in the technical working group over all the years, and still continue to do, is to just rein that in a little bit at a time. And I think actually FOTA, which, you know, I hope we're not seeing the demise of FOTA, because it's done many good things, but the one thing it's done that has been absolutely fantastic is bringing those costs down, as well as bringing a lot of innovation, which we can talk about as well.
Just out of interest, how many pages is the rule book now?
I think that the main technical regulations run into the high 80s, and then there's about a similar number in the appendix. And then, of course, you've got the sporting regulations, which do have some technical content in them as well. You need to...
It's
so difficult to remember all the aspects of it.
Bedtime reading, I reckon.
On the point of FOTA, Pat, did the resource restriction work last year?
Certainly did for our team. Yes, we had no danger of breaking through that. I think it did. There are many aspects to the resource restriction, and people focus a little bit on the headcount and the external spend part of it, because there are rumours, it's alleged, etc., etc., that, you know, people have gone through it. But they forget many of the other things. You know, the fact, the engine limitations, which, you know, brought the number of engines we used down from sort of 150 to, well, less than 20. The testing restrictions, you know, which really they once the test teams were disbanded, there was a huge saving for the teams. Wind tunnel restrictions and CFD restrictions, all of them done an awful lot to save money. They're all FOTA initiatives initially. Some of them still exist outside of FOTA, so even if FOTA does cease to exist, there are legal documents signed by the teams which are binding outside of FOTA that I think still have to be applied, although I'm sure that there might be others who may not agree with me. And the other good thing is, you know, a lot of these initiatives have now actually been encompassed in the FIA rules. So, yeah, there have been a lot of good things coming from it. And I do think, you know, financially, Formula One is hardly sustainable at the moment. And without the work that has been done by the TWG, by the TRWG, which is the equivalent within FOTA, it would be even less sustainable than it is now.
Yeah. But how can FOTA continue to have an influence with Ferrari and Red Bull not at the table?
It's difficult, isn't it? And the trouble is, of course, that really this just takes us back a little bit to why FOTA was formed. We're in Concorde negotiation year. As of January the 1st, 2012, the negotiations on Concorde, the next Concorde, open up. Because, interestingly, within the last Concorde, there was a clause which said you can't do deals before January the 1st, 2012. And now we're past that. And it's interesting because FOTA really was formed very much on the back of doing the last Concorde agreement, and it's interesting, it looks like it might break down on the back of the new Concorde, and that's a great shame, I think, because I think that, you know, the teams can do an awful lot, and I really hope that in negotiating with the commercial rights holder, with Bernie, we don't lose the other good things. We don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Now, having said that, I think that the culture and the mindset within Formula One is very different to that which existed just a few years ago when FOTA was formed. And we do have these things now where people are a bit more prepared than they used to be to actually give up a little bit in the interests of the sport. Providing we continue with that, then the loss of FOTA won't be the end of the world. But I do hope we do continue with that.
Yeah.
I honestly don't think you'd have got... Although DRS wasn't a FOTA initiative, it was an FIA initiative. I don't think you'd have got that without this sort of general consensus that you have within teams now? Now, I know Nigel doesn't like that, but it was perhaps not a great example to use.
Should we give up the DRS at some point?
I fundamentally entirely agree with you. I think FOTA is almost a necessity. I think I would be very, very sad to see it disintegrate.
Yeah.
I like Damon Hill's description of DRS. He calls it that flappy wing that allows you to overtake and then be overtaken again.
That flappy wing, are you sure he wasn't talking about the front of the Red Bull?
You said it, Pat. Actually, as we mentioned Red Bull and its front wing, do you think, Pat, that bearing in mind we don't have that many rule changes for this year, the double diffuser's gone, but do you see a big change in the form book, or do you think that...
Yeah, interesting question, because, yeah, we have less changes and clarifications this year than normal. There are two sort of fundamentals in my mind. One is the repositioning of the exhausts, and the other is the very recently recently clarified rule that has effectively doubled the stiffness of the front wings. There are areas where people have been working very hard. I think with the exhausts, there was definitely a have and have not. And I think it was very clear that the front part of the grid had and the rear part of the grid had not. Again, I suppose, you know, with my Russia hat on, I'm not sorry to see that go. It was a very complex technology to get to work right. And yes, I think that will close the field up a little bit. The front wing's stiffness, I think most people were exploiting that and exploiting it quite effectively, and they will continue to do so, even if it's half the amount. So I don't think that's a game changer. So fundamentally, I don't think we're really going to see the grid shaken up. I think we might see it close up a little bit. You know, I think there will be other changes that might be as significant. You know, Williams with the Renault engine, what's that going to do to them? It's things like that are interesting.
I must say I'm intrigued by the stories coming out of Italy, and including, you know, Domenicali himself talking about the forthcoming Ferrari. They're already ahead of time making excuses for how ugly it is, and I wonder, yeah, in what way then is it going to be radical? What do you think?
I think you're going to see a lot of ugly cars this year, and I think this was a little bit of a I was praising the teams for sticking together and doing sensible rule changes, and I'm now going to give an example when they didn't. And the FIA decreed that nose height needs to reduce, and this is largely from the work that's been going on within the FIA Institute about launching of cars when they run into the back of other cars. And we will, and in fact in the 2014 regulations that are published, you'll see the nose height is considerably lower. Now, there was a stage of that done for 2012. Now, in doing that, it would have been sensible if they'd lowered the height of the front bulkhead. And, you know, we've talked about how many pages of regulations there are, and would you believe, you know, the front bulkhead is a very regulated thing. It has to be a certain height, it must be a certain height above the ground or relative to the cockpit. You know, its position is regulated. And some teams didn't want that changed, even though the nose height had been changed. And it is going to lead to some pretty ugly cars, I think. It's certainly, you know, obviously I've investigated it. I'm very pleased to say the Marussia, of course, will be a very good-looking car. But there will be some who where there's a distinct step at the front of the chassis down onto the nose, and I think that's what they're talking about. It does leave a little more area under the chassis to work with, but... we tried very hard to exploit that and really couldn't get it working, so we decided to go with something a bit more conventional. But I'm quite sure that several teams will have kept the front bulkhead high along with a low nose just to give them that area to work in later.
This is bad news. Ugly cars. Bad news.
Pat, you're working now for one of the so-called new teams, but they're not new anymore. And the struggle is to get those teams up into the midfield and then eventually further forward. Given how tight things are, both with resources, with the rules, how are these new teams ever going to get into the midfield on performance alone?
Well, firstly, we are a new team, and I think we're the newest team, because effectively we totally ripped up our organisation and redid it on July the 4th, 2011. So I think that makes us pretty damn new. an awful lot of changes have happened since then. But you're right, you know, it's difficult. I said earlier that, you know, financially Formula One is barely sustainable, and by that I mean that, you know, at the front it's barely sustainable, at the back it's very, very difficult, and you know, the recession does have a very significant effect on sponsorship that you pull in. We have set, you know, I think we are typical of the small teams. We've set ourselves targets, we've set ourselves some very regulated growth. I think, you know, what I'm trying to add to it is just a real sort of integrity in our engineering, so we really think about what we do. We don't do things for the sake of it. We try and work very efficiently, and I think that's something, you know, going back to the Benetton days that we had, I think we punched above our weight, and certainly at Marussia I hope we can punch above our weight, but boy, times are difficult at the moment.
So would you say that it's basically starting from scratch from July? And you're going with a more conventional approach?
In
now.
Many, many ways, yes. You know, on July the 4th, 2011, as I said, you know, we took over the elements that used to be Worth. We moved into factory in Banbury. We got the race team down in the goodness of time into that factory. We moved marketing in there. We totally reorganized the aerodynamics department, started recruiting. Haven't really had to reorganize the design department. It was actually, you know, that was working very well, as were elements of the aerodynamic department. It was just a question of tweaking it and directing it a little bit. So yeah, lots of very new things there.
All in the middle of the season.
Yeah, absolutely. And but you know what, we'd done an upgrade to the car, which eventually appeared in Singapore, even though we called it the Silverstone upgrade. we originally had been planned for Silverstone, but of course that was just at the time when the takeover happened and everything. But apart from that, we really didn't touch that car last year. We solved any serious faults on it, but left it alone. And the race team, people like Dave Greenwood, the chief engineer there, did a fabulous job just keeping the car racing while we got on and tried to set things up. And you know, that includes a wind tunnel program, our new deal with McLaren, all these things that really were so new.
You've mentioned the deal with McLaren before. I mean, what exactly does that involve? Is it sort of information or parts?
Very few parts. We're not about to reinvent the wheel, so if there's something we know of that McLaren use that's a non-Concord part, because obviously there are lots of bits we can't use, including effectively anything that affects the performance of the car. But you know, simple things, we're using some valves in our fuel system that come from McLaren because we knew they had them, we didn't want to redesign them, but it really is very few parts. It's much more about knowledge and IP, and again, within the bounds of the Concord Agreement, which does say that as a constructor, you must own the IP of your car and the IP of those areas that affect performance. So it's a really wide-ranging thing, and it goes from use of their wind tunnel, use of their test rigs, to all sorts of things that are really good for a new team, you know, even down to supply chain and buyers and things like that, you know, where we get things from, how we get the best prices and what have you. And it was very much an idea that as a new team, and really to answering the question that was asked before, as a new team, how do we move forward? And the answer is, well, you do it the same as everyone else and you plod your way up to the front, and you might make it, you might not. Andrei Chegakov, who is the man behind Marussia, wanted to do it quicker than that. So the idea was we had to do something different. We had to sort of move off this sort of line that's been used so often before. And the idea was to align ourselves with McLaren and learn a lot of process and procedure and things like that. So it's that type of IP, and I have to say, I think it will be successful.
Do you think that's partly why Force India have come on so well recently? Do you think it's the connection with McLaren that's been part of that?
I think it's helped them. Their deal is not really the same as ours. It's not quite so much about that sort of IP side of things, but they do use, for example, they use a McLaren simulator, as indeed we do, and things like that will help. And, you know, you can't help but some of that culture rubbing off.
Yeah.
But let's not take anything away from Force India. I think they've done a super job this year. Well, the last few years, to be honest. You know, they're not the best finance team on the grid. And I admire them.
Yeah.
Pat, you mentioned earlier about the change to the regulation about the exhaust exits. How much downforce can you quantify?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How much of a loss that is to the top teams who had got it right?
It's an interesting question, difficult one to answer, and I've been trying to answer that myself, you know, right through the year. I think that what you've got to remember is that it becomes very engine dependent, and the fact is that if you when the engine is working hard and really helping that diffuser, I think the answer is way over 10%, maybe 20%. But of course, it's not doing that all the time. So you're really then talking about the average over the lap. And I think that what we saw last season was that people were able to get more and more of that lap average up. And that was largely because of what was happening with the engines. I don't think that the aerodynamics per se changed that much. I think, you know, from the beginning of the season, those who got it right had got it right. And then I think the improvements after that really came from the engine. I think it's significant. I really do. Well, you know, even on those numbers, and they're not exaggerations. They might, if anything, be underestimates. But yeah, you know, those sort of numbers are very, very significant numbers.
And I think this is probably a question you won't give me a straight answer to. But in terms of clawing back that lost downforce, what areas are we going to be looking at this year, do you think?
Firstly, I mean, people will of course try and claw it back, and I think most people will be setting targets for themselves to try and get back to the sort of level they were at last year, albeit without a very blown diffuser. I don't think we've seen that go away completely. I really don't, and I think that although the rules are well written to define the exhaust position, I think there are still a few things that can be done, and I think we'll see those things right from the beginning of testing. The rest of it will just come from aerodynamic refinement. Now, of course, there might be something out there, you know, this year's double diffuser or F-duct or something like that that I don't yet know about, I haven't thought about, and someone else might bring something along, you know, that is a game changer. But assuming that's not the case, and even if it is, you know, the rest of the work will just be about refinement with a relatively stable set of regulations.
Pat, you're talking about engines there. How is it, how much of a disadvantage, if any, is it to be running a Cosworth engine against these incredibly high performance and efficient and reliable manufacturer engines?
I think the Cosworth engine is a pretty powerful engine. I don't think, you know, there's a real problem in that area. But when you get to the intricacies of mapping the engine with a view to enhancing other areas of the car, and really, I mean aerodynamics, then I think that the Ferraris, Renaults and Mercedes-Benz of the world are probably a fair way further along. Now, that's not because Cosworth couldn't do it, it's because Cosworth are working with teams that can't afford to do it. You know, it's a commercial thing. If Renault or Mercedes or Ferrari make that decision that they are going to invest in engine mapping, they just go and do it. If we want to do that, it costs us an awful lot of money to go on the dyno and do that mapping.
And Rubens always said about the Cosworth that it was just what you said. He thought on horsepower it didn't really lack much at all. But he reckoned that on drivability it was... It wasn't as good as other engines he'd experienced before.
Yeah, I think you know, it's always difficult with these things, and the grass is always greener on the other side, isn't it? But there have been, with the young driver tests in Abu Dhabi, there have been a few cases of people who've driven more than one car that week, and that's when you start to get, okay, they might be young guys, but you know, they're still pretty reasonable drivers. And I think that they would probably echo Rubens's thoughts.
As we're at the halfway stage of today's podcast, let me tell you about the Motorsport Magazine Hall of Fame. On the 16th of February, we will be at the Roundhouse in Camden in London to host our annual Hall of Fame. So far, we've inducted 16 people into this virtual Hall of Fame, including Dario Franchitti, Mario Andretti, Sir Frank Williams, Enzo Ferrari, Jim Clark, and Ayrton Senna. Four more greats will be joining this list on Thursday, the 16th of February, and you can be there to celebrate with us. All you have to do is go to the Hall of Fame section on our new website, which is, in case you don't know, www.motorsportmagazine.com, and you can enter a competition to win tickets to be with us at the Roundhouse in London on the 16th of February. So I hope we will see some of you there. That would be great. And just to tell you, it's also a good time to sign up to a subscription. Now, this is important because it keeps us going. And we're offering 30 issues for the price of 24, or 15 for the price of 12. And that is until the end of February this year. 30 for the price of 24, 15 for the price of 12. The offer is available worldwide, so you can get your savings wherever you are. If you've got any questions about that, then you can email us at subscriptions@motorsportmagazine.co.uk. Okay. Pat, we've had a remarkable number of questions on Twitter. Are you on Twitter?
No, I don't tweet.
You don't tweet?
I occasionally roar, but I never tweet.
Okay, well, we might get a mild roar from this question. Who knows? It comes from Jeff Collins, and he wants to ask you, Pat, how hard would it be to take a set of photographs of a Red Bull and implement some of the things on that car, on your car? We're not suggesting you do it, by the way. We're just asking how hard that kind of thing would be.
Well, I think every team does it, actually. you know, teams do have armies of photographers at the circuits taking photographs of competitors' cars all the time, yeah. And they're carefully analysed. I think, you know, within the bounds of what you can do with photographs, people even make measurements and survey the other cars. But one of the what I think is interesting about this question is The answer is you can't really do it, in spite of all that. Yes, you get ideas and you look at trends and you look at where people are working, and, you know, by looking at differences from one race to the next, you say, okay, these guys have changed their front wing, they're working in this area. If you suddenly find they've got a lot of performance, it might guide you into that area. But the cars really have to work as a whole. You can't take anything in isolation. So you really have to make the whole thing work together. And in addition, you know, if you don't understand something, you're never going to make it work. So just blind copying really gets you nowhere. Same at school, you know.
Something that's always baffled me is that, you know, on the grid of a Formula One race, the Red Bull mechanics are always stood round the back of the Red Bull, blocking it off. But surely a photographer can just snap that coming out of the pits. Is this just show?
Or is it part of the fun, I think. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. That's the story of Colin Chapman with the kettle, I think, when they were trying to disguise some work they were doing on the differential or something. The mechanics used to cover something up and always walk out with it, and everyone was following that. And apparently it was just a kettle under a under a cover.
I think the more of that, the better. I like all
absolutely.
That. I like all that holding a sheet over things. So that's fantastic. This is a bit different. It comes from Lorenzo Maimoni, and he wonders, Pat, whether you can tell us anything about why Massa would appear to have been struggling in 2011. It just didn't seem to be right on it. And you must have seen this many times in your career.
Yeah, I think there are two things here. One, we were talking earlier about self-esteem and how important it is to sportsmen. And it's something that's very fragile. So when you start to get that crack in the facade, it opens up. And, you know, is there a harder guy to go up against than Fernando? Not sure. So I don't think that's helped at all. But I think perhaps more significantly are the Pirelli tyres. And the Pirelli tyres really are quite different. And we've seen it before, you know, when people have changed from Michelin to Bridgestone and Goodyear to Michelin, and, you know, you go back as far as you like. That tyres are complex things. They require certain styles of driving. And some guys can... Well, maybe their natural style fits that tyre, but some guys can change their style. They can understand the tyre. And I wonder if Felipe hasn't perhaps lost out a little bit on that, as I believe maybe Mark Webber has.
And in the other direction, Michael, you know, was infinitely more at ease on the Pirellis than he had been on the Bridgestones.
Well, one of the things with Michael, of course, and, you know, having worked with him for many years, to me, he is the absolute master of altering his driving style to suit the car. He used to be absolutely incredible. You know, in the days when we used to have lots of practice and lots of qualifying and even a warm-up on Sunday morning, he used to work and work and work to get the car as good as he could all the way, even through qualifying. You know, there's no parc fermé then, you could do what you like. So middle of qualifying, you'd be changing springs and roll bars and all this sort of stuff. And he used to get to Sunday morning when we used to have a half-hour warm-up in the morning before the race. And in that, he used to, at that point, he'd sort of say, right, done everything I can, I've got what I've got, now I'll spend half an hour just seeing if I can extract a little bit more out of it and change my driving style. And, you know, in the days before we had all the instrumentation, because Michael has been around a while, we used to put a little... cheap Casio watch on the steering wheel, and cheap, you know, I'm talking about something. I seem to remember going into Samuel's and buying about 20 of them. They're about 10 quid each or something. We used to glue these onto the steering wheel, and he used to actually press the buttons and time himself in certain bits of the circuit and try different things, sometimes as simple as a different gear in the corner. Yeah. More often a different line, and he used to be really good at adapting his style to the car that we'd given him, and that's why I think, you know, he's learned how to drive on Pirellis.
That is fascinating, isn't it?
It's interesting that he never
got himself comfortable on Bridgestones, really, did he? He did allude to that once or twice, just sort of never made a meal of it. But
in the Mercedes,
yeah,
in the first year of the comeback. Yeah,
yes,
but what did what you know? He, I've often wanted to talk to him about this and never have done, because I think it's fascinating that he came back to a totally different car aerodynamically. And any aerodynamicist in Formula One will know that the aerodynamic maps of those 2009 onwards cars are so different to the earlier ones. He came back to no refueling, you know, and he'd been the master of the sprint and all that sort of stuff. So I think he actually had so many things to cope with, and in spite of that, that's right. And so, in spite of what I said, I think, you know, he may well have been on overload as he got into that lot.
As we're on the subject of Michael Schumacher, and I am trying to get in as many Twitter questions as possible, because after all, these are the people who support the magazine. Tom Arnold wants to know, Pat, whether you could have or might have gone to Ferrari with Michael. Was it a
well, Tom, it's interesting. At the time, yes, of course, the opportunity was there. Ross had made it known he was going to Ferrari, and he really was pushing a lot for me to become technical director of Benetton, which I felt was a much much more interesting challenge. You know, I think the other way it was same SH1T, different shirt, you know, whereas this was a new challenge. And so I was quite keen to do that. But some years later, actually, yes, I did consider joining Ferrari, and I think I got as far as, in fact, probably still got it at home somewhere, a contract from them, but never actually signed it.
Do you find that, this is another a question from here, is it that in your current, I believe that you're sort of, is it right, a consultant for Marussia?
That's right, that'd be fair. Absolutely.
I mean, in the way now, you've got sort of, you've got the world is your oyster, isn't it? Because you can take opportunities much more easily than, say, you could if you were, you know, the technical director of a big team.
Well, yes and no, but, you know, over this last year I've done some quite interesting work, including some work on aerodynamics of road cars, which was really fascinating, really enjoyed it. So it's given me that opportunity, but I do actually have a very strong moral commitment to Marussia. I really like the team, I really like the people, I really like what they're doing, and I wouldn't at the moment consider going and working for another Formula One team. And of course, in my consultancy agreement, I can't work for another Formula One team, obviously. But yeah, a really, really nice team. Really enjoy it.
That's good to hear. Good to hear. Ben Harris wants to know whether you think that raw car speed has actually hit the limits of the tracks we use these days. And if so, you know, are we constantly searching for clever ways to get them quicker through the corners? And
well, no, I don't think it has. Again, you know, this is superb work done by the FIA Institute on making the tracks safer. And, you know, we've seen the new barriers, the high-speed barriers, the tech barriers, all these sort of things, as well, of course, as continually improving standards on the cars themselves. You know, some circuits we can't change. You know, you can't suddenly say, well, let's have huge runoff areas at Monaco. It ain't going to happen. I do think, you know, again, the work of the TWG is to, let's say, to limit performance, to make sure it doesn't go too far. And, you know, a while ago we brought the engines down from 3.5 litres to 3 litres to 2.4 litres. We've continually limited the aerodynamic performance of the cars. I think we get the balance pretty good at the moment. There's a lot of work in it, hell of a lot of work, but I think that there's some good people working well on it.
How do you feel? Sorry, Damien.
I was just going to say, on that point, Pat, for the future, what does the 2014 regulations excite you?
Yeah, they do. I think the powertrain regulations are really interesting. It's a huge challenge. You know, you're now dealing with a system, and it's absolutely correct to call it a powertrain, not an engine, because it really is a system. And the way you use the energy that you've been given is a real challenge. Now, it's a nerdy challenge, it's an engineer's challenge. But nevertheless, it's one that actually is all for the common good, because I really do believe that the current KERS system was a step in the right direction, but there were so many things weren't right. The way we were allowed to control KERS wasn't right, the power of it wasn't right, the ratio of KERS power to internal combustion engine power was wrong. 2014 puts a lot of these things right, and I really, really genuinely believe that some of the methodologies that come out of the 24 powertrain regulations really will make a difference in the medium term to road cars. Now, I don't think hybrids are the long-term answer, but I do think that there's a medium-term answer there.
What about electric pit lane? You know, I mean, silent cars coming down the pit lane. I don't like the sound of that very much.
Well, you can't like the sound of something that's silent.
No, silent. Thank you very much.
But is there a safety concern there?
No, they won't be silent. Honestly, if you occasionally, even when we run these cars up in the garage with silencers on, you know, take the exhaust out the back, you should hear how those gearboxes rattle and things like that. I think the electric pit lane is quite interesting. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Well, in real terms, it doesn't do much for you, but you know, we've got to remember that we are a show as well, and if we want to show that we are really going in this electric hybrid world, then what better way of doing it than saying, look, you know, reminding people 20, 30, 40 times every couple of weeks that these are electric cars as well. And I think that's quite good.
I thought the smart money was on hydrogen for the future of our road trip.
Hydrogen is just a means of transporting energy. I'm getting too technical.
No, not at all. Probably not for people listening, yeah, and that's my job.
Hydrogen is an energy storage medium like many things. You have to produce the hydrogen.
Yeah.
You know, you have to get the hydrogen, and it takes power to do that. And yes, maybe it is. And this is why I say that hybrids are a medium-term solution, not a long-term solution. Hydrogen fuel cells particularly are probably the way of the future. But they are a fair way away. We need some real enabling technologies to move, particularly in fuel cells, to that sort of state. Hybrids have a role. It may only be for 10, 20, 30 years, I don't know, but they do have a role.
We should ask one killer question for this year as well, with the dreaded DRS. Do we need it now? Do you think we need it? Is it still required?
I was hoping you were going to ask Nigel.
Well, I think Nigel will give us his opinion. Well, I'll tell you what, Pat, let's start off from the premise that nothing to do with me, something Ross said, that on the evidence of last year, he thinks the tyre factor is enough to have, you know, reawakened Formula One from
I think that that's probably true.
State.
And certainly, yeah, we had a thrilling year of racing, there's no doubt about it. And I would probably, if I had to put a number on it, I'd say that was 80% tyres and 20% DRS. The tyres were fundamental. But I still think DRS has a part to play, and for a year where we were discovering how to use DRS, I don't think it worked badly, and I think with a little bit of trimming next year, it'll be better again. Yes, you could argue that you don't happen to need it right at the moment because of the way the tyres are working, but you know, that can change. A couple of years, are Pirelli going to be supplying the tyres? Are they going to have the same philosophy? I don't think it's a bad thing.
So much comes down to Pirelli, doesn't it, in terms of the tyres they produce. They had that parameters that don't do too good a job last year, and they have to sort of stick to that to keep it interesting.
Yeah, I mean, they really need to come back from where they were in the back end of last season, don't they? Because when they were getting to the point when they were doing too good a job.
I can't heap enough praise on Pirelli. I think it's It's a really brave thing they've done. It's really good for the sport. I think that the people understand it. They don't criticise Pirelli. They don't say, oh, their tyres don't last. I think they've had really good publicity from it. And I think they were very brave, very bold, and I really salute them.
It's a bit different to the Pirelli you knew from the mid-80s, isn't it?
I started with Pirelli in 81 when they came into Formula One, and it's moved on a bit since then, that's for sure.
Pat, can you explain something to me which I've never understood amongst many things I don't understand, and that is, you talked about Massa and Webber possibly not being comfortable with the tyres. I don't fully understand what that means, I'm afraid. I mean, is it that sensitive?
Neither do Massa and Webber, I guess. Is it that sensitive? To be honest, I don't know. I was speculating. I certainly don't know that's the reason.
People do talk about, how Vettel is really great on these tyres, but yeah, Someone else isn't.
Well, you know, as I say, tyres are very subtle things. They have subtle nuances. And, for example, some tyres are much better at sustaining a cornering load while they've also got a fore and aft load on them. So if you've got a tyre like that, a driver who goes very, very deep into the corner on the brakes, he'll be fine on it. If that's the way he drives, and you then change to a tyre which won't sustain a cornering load while it's got a braking load on it, that driver will then find that one of his ways of driving is no longer valid. He's got to change his style a little bit. He's got to get his braking done much more in a straight line before he turns in. Some tyres, well, no tyre likes a sudden movement. You know, tyres like to be treated gently, but some are more tolerant than others. So if you've got a driver who's very smooth and you've got a tyre that really doesn't like sudden movements and sudden changes of direction and sudden changes of forces, then that smooth driver is going to benefit more than he would on a tyre that's very tolerant to those sort of things. So there are lots of nuances in the tyre that a driver can exploit. If I knew them all, I guess I'd be a driver. And I think they are quite difficult.
I think it's fascinating. I got to say,
Pat. What do you think about Ferrari's move, importing their very own Bridgestone man? Well, I mean, Bridgestone as was, but essentially just a pure, this is how tyres work.
Yeah, it is an interesting move, and I first came across Hammy in Formula 2 days, actually, when Bridgestone first came to Europe, and he was part of it. I was racing Formula 2, actually, with Pirelli then, and they did a fantastic job in those early days, and Hammy was very much, the man who did that. I think, in more recent years, he's become very much more a manager, this very senior technical manager. And, of course, the science has moved on enormously in those days, and indeed, even beyond that. We really did very little tyre modelling. That stuff started to come out of the universities and things like that, and we adopted it. More recently, we got into the thermal modelling of tyres, which is very much something that's happened within racing and has fed out the other way. Don't get me wrong, Hammy's a very clever guy. Quite a coup, I think, for Ferrari to get him into Italy.
Had you ever heard that idea discussed?
Had you ever heard that idea discussed by any other team at any point?
Oh, yeah. No,
yeah, but nobody actually ever
Yes, they have. Yes, in Force India, there's one of the Bridgestone guys in there as well.
Is that right?
And in fact, really? In most of the teams now, there is someone who has worked within racing tyre industry.
Okay.
We're nearly out of time, regrettably, because it's been fascinating, as ever, with Pat Simmons. But we started right an hour ago talking about reactive ride height system. Will we know by the end of February how good that is, or will it be something that takes longer? I mean, if it's really that good, will it immediately be will the Lotus be quickest in Spain in testing?
No, I don't think so. Everything's about aerodynamics, and while we call this a reactive ride height system, or people call it a reactive ride height system.
Well, I did call it the braking something.
Whatever it's called, it's not about suspension, okay. To be honest. It's about exploiting the aerodynamic platform. What we will see in February, as always, is we're never quite sure, are we, at the end of testing, who's really quick and who's sort of hiding things and what have you. But as the season progresses, I suspect that this is a sort of an enabling technology. It's a technology that's really there to exploit aerodynamics. It's not fundamental. You can look at some of the things that have come along in the last few years, like the inerta, which, you know, it was very much about the ride of the car and improving the grip and stuff like that, with a very small influence on aerodynamics. This one, I think, is much more about aerodynamics.
Okay. I don't like the sound of ugly cars, but let's make up our own minds when we see them roll out. Anyway. Let me remind you before we go that we do now have an iPad edition. Yep, we're gone digital, then we have an iPad version of our magazine. So if you're already a print subscriber, you can access every edition on your iPad absolutely free. And if you're not, you can buy copies, of course, on the newsstand, or you can become a digital subscriber. It's the same content as the magazine, only there's more of it, including more photographs and slideshows and videos and links to audio podcasts and the website. So, Pat, if you've got an iPad, you can listen to your podcast.
Of course I've got an iPad.
Of course. Well, how stupid. What a stupid question. Okay, and it's a good time to sign up too for a subscription, because we're offering 30 editions for the price of 24. Can work out that 6 free ones, or 15 issues for the price of 12, and this goes right through till the end of February of this year. The offer is available worldwide, so you can receive massive savings wherever you are. If you've got any questions, email us at subscriptions@motorsportmagazine.co.uk. And I'm just going to throw you one last ball, Pat, which shows you just how much attention people pay when they fall in love with Formula One. Because Dave Charles wants to know, what kind of metal is it in the chain that you always wear around your neck? I know, it's quite good, isn't it? I quite like it, actually.
I'm very impressed. It is silver. It's handmade. It was designed by my wife and made by a small jeweller in the town where I live, and he is observant.
Fantastic, I love it. Well, that's a great note to end on. And Dave Charles, good question, well done, thank you very much. Now you know. Fantastic. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed it as much as we all did. My thanks to Nigel and to Ed and to Damien, of course, and to Alan, who records all this for us so well, and Pat Simmons, thank you very much for coming in. That's
my pleasure.
It for now. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.